Part 11 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Scrutinies, Part 3.
All right, and with that we shall proceed in our discussions now. We have concluded 4 sermons on the last occasion, and so that leaves us now 3 more. So the narrative goes on. The following night, the dead appear once more, and in their increasingly insolent manner, they approach noisily, pushing, shoving, and scoffing, as they exclaim, "Teach us, fool, about the church and Holy Communion," as the text in this edition of the Red Book has it, but it is better translated as Holy Community. In fact, later on, the word community is mentioned again, so this initial introduction is a somewhat faulty translation. Philemon then begins to speak, and he begins with the first sentence of the 5th sermon. "The world of the gods is made manifest in spirituality and sexuality. The celestial ones appear in spirituality, the earthly in sexuality." Now there are a couple of things to keep in mind here. When speaking of the gods, we once again need to keep in mind that the beings or entities, archetypal forms here described as gods, are something very different from the concept of the monotheistic gods. Those of you who have some familiarity with Buddhism, particularly Mahayana Buddhism, would find probably an analogy in the Buddhist deities, and certainly not anything resembling the Jehovic monotheistic image. In 1925, in a seminar dealing with these visions, Jung said, "Sexuality and spirituality are pairs of opposites that need each other." Now, this subject can lead to a controversial field, because certainly there are many linkages of one kind or another between religion or spirituality on the one hand and matters relating to sexuality on the other. One may take cognizance of the Hindu teachings and practices relating to Kundalini, but also to traditional mystery practices of the West, ancient mystery practices. It is well known that it is, for instance, as an indication of this, it is well known that it is canonically not permissible in Catholic Christendom to ordain a eunuch to the priesthood, an issue that caused the Church Father Origen back in the early days of Christendom much difficulty, because he was a eunuch and he had a very hard time getting ordained. Also, in Freemasonry, it is not, I hope I am not being clandestine by mentioning this, it is not permissible to confer Masonic initiation on an old man in his dotage. One wonders why. So it seems plausible that some sort of sexually related energy was considered an essential ingredient of the practice of religious spiritual mysteries. Even though he considers these two principles linked, Philemon also distinguishes them markedly, and here are some of his words from the sermon. "The sexuality of man is more earthly, that of the woman is more spiritual. The spirituality of man is more heavenly. It moves toward the greater. The spirituality of woman is more earthly. It moves toward the smaller." And then come some sentences containing, again, some rather dubious translation, such as, "Mendacious and devilish is the spirituality of man, And then it says, and it moves toward the smaller. In the German original translates as when it moves toward the smaller, which certainly makes more sense. And then it goes on, mendacious and devilish is the spirituality of woman, in the gender word, and is here when it should be when it moves toward the greater. Now, the inadequate translation here is quite serious and glaring. The only possible excuse for it might be that the translators were using, in addition to the version written down and published by Jung in his little book, and subsequently in the Red Book, other alternative German texts, which may be at times different from the one that Jung published. I would advise readers to avail themselves, if they are thus inclined, of my translation, which followed exactly the German text in Jung's small book. Now, once again, the context justifies the translation that differs from the translation in this Red Book. But the technicalities of translation aside, what is the sermon saying to us here? Jung seems to enumerate certain profound psychological characteristics of the male and the female psyche. One needs to keep in mind also that the word translated, and I'm sorry to come back to translation again, so I am both blessed and cursed with the fact that I know German. You know, if I didn't, then I could just gloss over all of this blissfully, as no doubt many people do. But so that the word translated as spirituality here, and it's the German word Geistigkeit, and that is at least idiomatically different from the contemporary meaning in the English language and the popular meaning of spirituality. Geist in German means spirit, but it also means mind. For instance, the German word for what in English we call the liberal arts is the Geisteswissenschaften, the spiritual sciences. Okay? So it's a much wider concept. So we may be justified in assuming that we are dealing here with a psychological meaning rather than with the metaphysical religious one of spiritual, that we would call spiritual. Now, of course, all such terms are used often in a very vague and a very imprecise and incorrect way by a lot of people. And so nowadays there is a great deal of talk and very little practice of spirituality. And, you know, people will often say, oh, I'm not religious, but I'm spiritual. And if you have then exchange a few more words with the person, then you see what what an example of mendacity that was. But in any event, thus we may be dealing here with a certain psychological meaning. So one might say that there are certain differences between the psychology of men and women. And that certainly is part of Jungian psychology. It has always been known as being a part of it. And masculine psychology might, in this view, have a tendency to move toward abstractions, while feminine psychology might tend toward the pragmatic and personal approach. On the other hand, masculine sexuality may be said to be intensely instinctual in orientation, while feminine sexuality may be more complex, strongly mingled with emotional elements. So such distinction may be viewed with suspicion in the contemporary feminist era, but it is difficult to deny such distinctions entirely or to deny them a measure of validity. So the sermon continues to expostulate upon the two principles, spirituality and sexuality, and admonishes people not to identify with either of them. The sermon calls these both powers that are not the property of any human, but that are collective powers that, instead of being possessed by humans, have a tendency to possess humans. And I think there we might refer to the sermons themselves. Let's just see where we are. Yeah. Spirituality and sexuality are not your qualities, says the sermon. Not things you possess and encompass. Rather, they possess and encompass you, since they are powerful daimons, manifestations of the gods, and hence reach beyond you, existing in themselves. So we are dealing with something sovereign and autonomous here. Instead, no man has a spirituality unto himself, or a sexuality unto himself. Instead, he stands under the law of spirituality and of sexuality. Therefore, no one escapes these daimons. You shall look upon them as daimons, and I use the word daimon because daimonion is, I think, the original Greek, and it certainly, you know, means a spirit, a spiritual power, not a demon, as in an infernal or evil entity in much modern usage. So, therefore, no one escapes these daimons. You shall look upon them as daimons and as a common task and a danger, a common burden that life has laid upon you. Thus, life too is for you a common task and danger, as are the gods, and first and foremost, the terrible Abraxas. So, the most likely interpretation of this is that these two powers of the collective unconscious, they are powers of the collective unconscious, and one must be on guard not to be overtaken by them, not to be possessed by them. It is easy to see in the case of sexuality, for we are all familiar with sexual obsessions, even to the point of dreadful crimes committed with perverted sexual motives. But what about spirituality? We need to recall that the Geistigkeit, spirituality mentioned here, is, as I just indicated, something somewhat different from what today colloquially we call spirituality. It is far better to think here of obsessions with ideas and concepts. An idea, a concept, an ideology, part of an ideology would definitely be considered part of Geistigkeit in German. So I think that that pertains here. And we may well remember that the greatest collective horrors visited upon humanity were the results of such obsessions. Attila, the Hun, possibly a distant relative of the Hungarians, you know. But we have changed a bit, you know. Attila, the Hun, saw himself as the scourge of God, chosen to punish peoples, as did Chaka, the mad Zulu king, in a later period of history. Hitler was possessed by the idea of the evil of the Jews, as Stalin, Mao, and the murderous Cambodian Marxist Pol Pot were possessed by the need to eliminate all real and imagined and even potential opponents to their regime. Thus, one needs to distance oneself from collective daimons. The temptation to become identified with ideas, indeed with systematized ideas, and to then live out all kinds of strange and unfortunate impulses under the auspices of these ideas is very, very great. And, of course, the self-serving way of dealing with this of various people is, oh, I am an idealist. Watch out. You know? There is a kind of idealism that can turn you into a veritable devil. People who are, you know, committing reprehensible acts because of selfish human motives, whatever they may be, greed, sex, heaven knows what else, you can do business with them because they are still human. But people who become possessed by ideas are very, very dangerous. There is no way of doing business with them. Very, very difficult situations arise in that fashion. So one needs to distance oneself from such collective daimons. The next subject addressed by Philemon in the fifth sermon is community. Not communion as indicated at the beginning by a somewhat inexact translation. Now here there are two opposites which are mentioned. And they are community and what once again in a somewhat labored fashion is called in the English text singleness, which might be more accurately translated as solitude. In any event, community and so-called singleness. Community is stated to be indispensable because of the weakness of humans. Singleness or solitude appears here as a euphemism for individualism, community for the collective. Interestingly, the sermon states that community exists because of man's weakness with regard to the gods and daimons and their invincible law. What may be meant by this? The gods and daimons, at least in my estimation, are archetypes, including violence, power, rapacious greed, and others. So community counteracts these forces and protects the powerless. But there is an interesting caveat in the sermon, which runs as follows. Insofar as the gods impose community upon you, it is necessary to the extent that this is imposed upon you by the gods. More is bad. So the last three words, I think, are significant. Collective social structures, as no doubt we are aware, very frequently become self-serving. They become oppressive, destructive, destructive of individuality and of freedom. Thus one needs to allocate only so much power to what here is called community, namely the state, government, and so forth, but no more. And of course that's difficult to do because governments attract power to themselves sort of in the manner in which a magnet attracts iron shavings. It's the nature of the beast. So it is up to the individual to say, so far and stop. We are not going to give more power to the community, to the collective, to the state. So the sermon concludes with the metaphoric statement, community gives us warmth, singleness gives us light. At the end of the sermon, the dead look upon Philemon with expectation, as if they expected more. Thus, for the first time, Philemon does not disappear, but continues with the next sermon without disappearing or departing. You may recall that in all the sermons when he spoke at the end and then usually discoursed for a while with Jung and gave him some explanations, then he disappeared. In this case, he does not. So the next, namely the fifth and the seventh sermon, both of these are much briefer than any of the preceding ones. The sermons sort of decrease in length toward the end. The sixth sermon concerns a further set of characteristics of the two world spirits, somewhat like the ancient Greek world spirits of Eros and Logos. Eros would be, of course, the sexuality. He calls sexuality here. Logos would be spirituality, again, in the sense of mind. So here, as in the fifth sermon, they are still called sexuality and spirituality. So this graphic symbolism, which we find in the sixth sermon, no longer merely a verbal description and allusion, but an imagery, which we will come to right away. This graphic symbolism of imagery brings these powers into greater and more dramatic focus than the largely conceptual account presented in the fifth sermon. The fifth sermon begins thus: the daimon of sexuality approaches our soul as a serpent. She is half a human soul and is called sought desire. The daimon of spirituality descends into our soul as the white bird. He is half human soul and is called sought desire. Now, the sermon takes advantage of the feature of the German language that assigns gender to nouns, which is, of course, something that we don't have in English. And thus, snake, Schlange, is a feminine noun, die Schlange, while the white bird is a masculine noun, der weiße Vogel. And thus, the daimon of sexuality is introduced as a feminine power and has the form of a snake. If we wanted to be very fancy and Greek here, we would say it's ophiomorphic. How would you like that, you know? So it's shaped, you know, like a snake. Contrary to Freudian phallic serpentine symbolism, which needs no further explanation, I think. Those who need such explanations may profitably find it elsewhere. they don't need to find it here. You know. And the bird, in terms, is introduced as masculine. Now, the sexuality serpent is revealed as being largely of a ctonic nature, namely related to the earth, coming out of the earth, and related to what is in the depths of the earth, underneath the earth. The white bird is definitely an airy celestial being, a messenger of, as Jung says it, of the Mater Celestis, the heavenly mother. Both beings are necessary and potentially helpful to the human. So we need to keep that in mind. After the conclusion of the sixth sermon, prompted by the contemptuous remarks of the dead — they are really problematic beings, shall we say — Philemon delivers a discourse to the dead, which the dead interrupt repeatedly. When Philemon had finished, the dead looked on with contempt and said, "Cease this talk of gods and diamonds and souls. We have known this for a long time." But Philemon smiled and replied, "You poor souls, poor in flesh and rich in spirit. The meat was fat and the spirit thin. But how do you reach the eternal light? You mock my stupidity, which you too possess. You mock yourselves. Knowledge frees one from danger, but mockery is the other side of your belief. Is black less than white? You reject faith and retain mockery. Are you thus saved from faith? No, you bound yourselves to mockery and hence again to faith, and therefore you are miserable." But the dead were outraged and cried. You know, when somebody calls you miserable, maybe you have some justification for being outraged and cry. On the other hand, the fundamentalists, you know, call us all miserable sinners. Perhaps that is an insult also. Sinners we may be, but why be miserable about it? So, and therefore you are miserable. But the dead were outraged and cried, "We are not miserable. We are clever. Our thinking and feeling is as pure as clear water." Boy, a little bit of inflation here. We praise our reason. We mock superstition. Do you believe that your old folly reaches us? A childish delusion has overcome you, old one. What good is it to us? Philemon replied, "What can do you any good? I free you from what still holds you to the shadow of life. Take this wisdom with you. Add this folly to your cleverness, this unreason to your reason, and you will find yourselves." In other words, you know, try to look at life and the various issues from a point of view different from the one that you are so attached to, which is your rationality, which is your logic, which is your enlightened opposition to superstition. If you were men, you would then begin your life. And your life's way between reason and unreason, and live onward to the eternal light, whose shadow you lived in advance. These are very portentous sentences. But since you are dead, this knowledge frees you from life, and strips you of your greed for men, and it also frees yourself from the shrouds that the light and the shadow lay on you. Compassion with men will overcome you, and from the stream you will reach solid ground. You will step forth from the eternal whirl onto the unmoving stone of rest, the circle that breaks flowing duration, and the flame will die down. And then he says, "I have fanned the glowing fire. I have given the murderer a knife. I have torn open healed over wounds. I have quickened all movement. I have given the madman more intoxicating drink. I have made the cold colder, the heat hotter, falseness even falser, goodness even better, weakness even weaker. This knowledge is the axe of the sacrificer." You can see that what he is saying here, what I have been doing to you, dead folk, with my sermons, was to intensify and to accelerate your inner nature, to wake you up, and then you might be able to sacrifice and to give up your obsessions with various ideas and concepts and beliefs which have kept you from the greater life. But the dead cried, "Your wisdom is foolishness and a curse. You want to turn the wheel back. It will tear you apart, O blinded one." Philemon replied, "So this is what happened. The earth became green and fruitful again from the blood of the sacrifice. Flowers sprouted. The waves crash into the sand. A silver cloud lies at the foot of the mountain. A bird of the soul came to men. The hoe sounds in the fields and the axe in the forests. A wind rushes through the trees and the sun shimmers in the dew of the risen morning. The planets behold the birth out of the earth, climbed the many-armed. The stones speak and the grass whispers. Man found himself, and the gods wander through heaven. The fullness gives birth to the golden drop, the golden seed, plumed and hovering." The dead now fell silent and stared at Philemon and slowly crept away. But Philemon bent down to the ground and said, "It is accomplished, but not fulfilled. Fruit of the earth, sprout, rise up, and heaven, pour out the water of life." Then Philemon disappeared. So Philemon is obviously talking to whom? Obviously the dead is a metaphor. And we have mentioned that before. I think you have quite often encountered people who were, well, let's say, dead from the neck up. or also dead in their heart, dead in their deeper feelings, dead in their more profound perceptions. In fact, such dead are quite common in this world. So who is he really talking to? He is obviously talking to contemporary rationalist and secularist people who resist and resent his Gnostic teaching and consider them backward and superstitious. When such teachings are taken improperly, and now this is very important, so this is hearkening back to what he just said, when such teachings are taken improperly by those whom he calls men, and of course here again there is a little linguistic difficulty, because what he's talking about is the German Mensch, which is the human, who are really human, whose humanity is not blinded by daimons, such as false ideas and so forth. So people who are obviously alive and receptive, they then, as Philemon says, begin their life. And this life is lived between reason and unreason, and leads toward the eternal light. Now these are particularly portentous words, worth remembering and meditating over. A great many people in our culture are like the dead here, and they need to reach a point of rest from the world. Those who can will become truly alive, spiritually alive, alive in a sense of growing in gnosis. And this is a notion that is, I think, first mentioned really with considerable power here by Philemon, but of we have intimations elsewhere. You know, when you manage to rid yourself of the forces that keep you from being truly alive, then you begin your life. You may think that you have been alive all along, but you really belong to the dead. Once again, this is, Jung is not the only person who recognized that. In his own way, with his own terminology, old George Ivanovich Gurdjieff mentioned it too and said that most people are sleepwalkers. That is how he put it. You know, they go through the motions, but they are not awake. They are not really alive. Have you ever done any sleepwalking? It's interesting. I did a little bit of it when I was a small child. I have seen others. It's kind of strange, you know, very frightening. Oh yeah, a sleepwalker really walks and he can climb like cats, you know. They get up on the roof. I knew a gardener of a relative of mine who was a very active sleepwalker. And, you know, at night you could hear him sort of going, whoo, and be walking up on the roof. If he had walked there that way when he was awake, I think he would have fallen off. So it's probably because then he would have been aware of the danger that he was in, which increases increases the danger. But let's say this is the sort of thing. We go through the motions, but we are not really living our life. We are meant to live a life different from the one that we are living. We are meant to live a life of meaning, of insight, of vision, of a contact with worlds and aeons that are filled with glory and wonder and magnificence, and certainly a profound understanding of the realities of life. That is what we are meant to do. Now, I don't need to tell you that if we look at our lives, that's not the way we are living. But this is a very important message of the Red Book, that we need to undergo a process which will make us truly alive. And then we will begin to live our life. Up to that time, well, again, you can use all kinds of metaphors and all kinds of words, but probably most people live a life of a so-called life, a pseudo-life of the society wherein they live. They live the life that television teaches them, oh heaven forbid, you know. It's not their life. It's not individual. It's not true. It's not whole, but it's very, very partial. And that is why Jung then, when he formulated his psychological ideas, most of them really after the writing of the Red Book, he called it individuation. Because then life becomes yours, not anybody else's. Not what you have taken in, whether it's from your parents or from society or from, heaven forbid, from the dingbats who teach at the universities. That's the worst kind of life that you can lead if you follow those people, you know. With due apologies to anybody here who may be teaching at a university, the very fact that they are here indicates they are not of that ilk. So it's perfectly all right. But your life, uniquely yours, filled with your individual ongoing meeting, and as he says, it moves toward the light. It moves toward enlightenment. And this is, of course, extremely important. But he says, well, many of these dead here, well, they can first withdraw from the foolishness that they have been living in, their obsession with their concepts, with rationalism, and experience a rest. And then they can come to a real life. And so what kind of life is that? I mean, I already mentioned quite a bit about it. But it is, this kind of Gnostic life is neither dominated by reason after the fashion of the rationalist, nor by the unreason of the superstitious believer. This is, of course, this has been our problem ever since the so-called era of the Enlightenment, which certainly had done a great deal of good in certain ways. At least the intellectual elite, the growing edge of Western culture, was obsessed with the idea of getting away from superstitious belief. And no doubt superstitious belief has done a lot of evil. But in order to do that, they moved into rationalism. And there they fell off the edge of the world of meaning once again. So whether you fall into unreason on the one hand or reason on the other hand, you are lost. So what is our proper position then? Where does that life that we are promised here really lie? It lies sort of in the razored edge path between unreason that is dominated to a large extent by unconscious pressures of various emotional forces and the rigid rationalism on the other. And in order to be fair and accurate, we need to also say that especially sort of since the era of the Enlightenment, but even going before, a lot of religion has become more and more rationalistic. So religion was accused, not without good reason, of having promoted, you know, emotional superstition. But then it went to the other extreme and became more and more rationalistic. And rationalistic religion, that's about one of the greatest self-contradictory kind of hybrids, horrible hybrids that exist. And yet a great deal of our religiosity is of that nature now also. So what we are looking for here, what Philemon is saying, there is a life that is inspirited by something else. And what is that something else, as he mentioned, by the power of the fullness, by the power of the pleroma. Now, I may be romanticizing here a little bit, but the Red Book probably more powerfully than any other work of Jung, but really all of the works of Jung that I have contact with from the very first time when I was in my teens back in Europe, when I first read some Jung, I was filled with the impression that behind these words there is a mysterious reality, that Jung's work was sort of the effulgence of something in the background that irradiates his work. And you have to discern that. It is not something that is out in the open, but that is in the back. And now I think with the Red Book, at least I have come to the conclusion that here is the documentation, here is the evidence of what was all along behind the words, the teachings, the ideas of Carl Jung. A visionary reality which has grabbed him quite early in his career and which never let go of him. Therefore, he was a man who lived his life. It had taken the dead weight away from him early in life, and he was able to live that life of meaning. And because he was doing that all along, he had the great desire to lead others to the same kind of recognition and ultimately to the same kind of life, which only partially and inadequately materialized, I think, really in his psychological teachings, because it is more than psychology. Psychology it is. After all, what is psychology? Linguistically, it's the language of the soul. And that's a good thing. It's a language that we all should learn. Unfortunately, I don't think they teach it in Berlitz or, any of the language courses that you can get. And yet we must learn the language of the soul. But once we learn the language, what happens then? Well, then we should expose ourselves to those who speak it. We have to speak it with somebody. We have to listen to it. The test of your knowledge of French is when you go to France. Like the test of my very inadequate and largely self-taught English was when I came to America. I thought that I spoke English, but very few people shared that view. So I really needed to rework the situation. So when we learn the language of the soul, psychology, then we need to speak with our soul as Jung speaks in the Red Book. Then we need to listen to what the soul tells us and where the soul leads us as it led him in the Red Book. And we need to then begin to live that greater life which has really been our calling and our destiny all along. This is the kind of life that is inspirited by something beyond itself. The whole world changes when that happens. And that is why Philemon brings forth here that sort of paradisical image where he speaks, now you look out and everything is happening, the flowers grow and the water flows and it flows in a way in which you have never seen it before. The flower grows in a way in which you have never observed it before. The fragrances are coming to you that were there all along, but you did not notice them. So the whole world is transformed because you have begun to live your life. But of course, the extroverted and largely rationalistic orientation does not allow us to see that, does not allow us to do that. We say, the world doesn't work right. Well, what else is new? So we got to do some things with the world. We got to change society. We got to change the ecology. we got to start doing away with global warming, so we won't freeze to death, as we have been recently. Always something outside, whether it's political, whether it's economic, whether it's scientific, but it is always outside. That if Philemon says, look, when you begin to live your life, you look out, and everything is glorious, and everything is absolutely right as far as your vision is concerned. You know, you are able to see a reality beyond the consensus reality. Now you say, you know, how do I do it? Next question, please. Well, however, I truly believe that all of us have done it, at least in small installments and occasionally already. We have had glimpses of that kind of life, because the true life does not come all at once. It's not a happening, but it's a process. And in the process, we have already gotten glimpses. Could be the inducements, the immediate inducements, the triggers to it might be anything. But we have had such moments. We have had such times. And if we are able to recollect them, not just visually, or certainly not just only intellectually, but in terms of a feeling tone, then it becomes like a thread of Ariadne. You hold it and you keep going, and it will lead you out of the maze into the fullness. This is what the seven sermons are to a major extent all about, that this possibility exists for us and that it definitely can happen. And Philemon depicts a changed world, this paradisical image. An image, as he says, that has been facilitated by a sacrifice. Now that worries us. Because we all have ideas of sacrifice and various ideas, and none of them are very pleasing. Especially when we have to make the sacrifice. As long as somebody else makes the sacrifice, that's all right. But in any event, you know, the sacrifice, we are concerned about that. But what sacrifice? What sacrifice is he speaking about here? He says, you know, I brought the axe of the sacrifice. It's the sacrifice of the lower, alienated, extroverted self. When that is sacrificed, when this is accomplished by gnosis, and it is, as he puts it here, it is not yet fulfilled. It is awaiting its fulfillment in the future, particularly as far as humanity is concerned. So Jung then has a further conversation with Philemon, in which he voices his astonishment at what happened in the course of Philemon delivering the sermons. Jung says, "What fires have you kindled? What have you broken asunder? Does the wheel of creation stand still?" You can see the change, big change in Jung's own attitude. You may recall in the earlier portions of the book, you know, Jung has that very Western attitude. In fact, he certainly was born and raised very far from there, but if he had been an American, he could have been from Missouri. Because he's always asking these great entities, including Philemon, you got to show me. So he's there, he's always questioning, he's always arguing, he's always, you know, you have to really show me, you have to really convince me, which is a good thing. Because when we just sort of, you know, bow to a great being and say, oh, you know, here you are, you're going to do it for me. In many ways we are following a pattern that we have been following for 2,000 years in the West with not as much profit as we could have had. Because we let somebody else do it for us. Somebody else gets on the cross and redeems us. So he asks and he questions and he argues, but now here toward the end of the great process, you can see that his attitude toward Philemon has changed in the sense that he sees the momentousness of what this being is communicating, and moreover what he is doing. He says, what fires have you kindled? What have you broken asunder? And Philemon tells him, among others, nothing has happened, and yet a sweet and indescribable mystery has taken place. When I read that, I won't quite tell you my reaction, but I was running for my handkerchief. Because a few times, as I'm sure you have too, and I hope maybe many times, we had that experience where you can say, nothing has happened. You look around, the room is still there, the books are still in the bookcase, the carpet is still on the floor, and yet a sweet and indescribable mystery has taken place. And Philemon says, I stepped out of the whirling circle. Responding to further questions by Jung, Philemon says, I stepped onto what is solid and took it with me and saved it from the wave surge, from the cycle of births, from the revolving wheel of endless happening. Now here again a little Buddhism comes to one's aid, because this is of course the image of the endlessly revolving cycle of births and deaths, the great wheel, which moves, and within which there are various divisions, and some of them are unpleasant, and some of them are pleasant, and some of them are sort of a mixture of both, but it keeps on turning, and it keeps on repeating. And usually when you have these mandalas in Buddhist iconography, then you have a wheel with a great big monster that could have come from Transylvania or somewhere, sort of like stepped out of a creature feature in the movies, with the big teeth and the claws that is holding the wheel. But when you look at the whole picture, off the wheel, off to the side in various directions, there are beautiful Buddhas with the halo around their head, sitting on lotuses and sort of very bemusedly looking down at that wheel. And the implication being, these are the souls that have gotten off the wheel. And here Philemon says the same thing, that what he has done now, he has stopped the wheel. He saved them from the cycle of births and from the revolving wheel of endless happening. So what we have here is, from our point of view, a description of the mystical experience of a high gnosis. The words of Philemon ring gloriously true when referring to the wheel. And then he says, this is direct quotation again, it has been stilled. So the experience of this kind of high gnosis lifts one from the wild surge of creation, including birth and death. And here one kind of has to disagree somewhat with the remnants of 19th century, largely 19th century occultism, which are so fond of reincarnation. Oh, you know, reincarnation, just oh, wonderful, wonderful thing. Well, you know, there are reasons for that attitude, because the reincarnational ideas were not present in Western culture at all for a very, very long time. And when they were sort of rediscovered from Eastern sources, they gave people a new window on what is happening. And that's always helpful. But, you know, you sit by a new window and keep looking out, and you see the same thing over and over, then you get tired of looking out the window, you know. And that's, of course, the issue. So Philemon points out, you know, you don't really get anywhere by being born over and over again. You get where you are supposed to get, namely to the real life, when you are able to step out of all of this and no longer be caught up in the great pattern within which you live. So Philemon then disappeared, as he does so often after a sermon, and Jung was still amazed and puzzled. Then the dead appeared once more, and with them there appeared Philemon, and the seventh and last sermon was delivered. Now the seventh and last sermon is a fairly brief one. It is the shortest of the sermons. And just because of that, and also because I think it is particularly pertinent to us, it has so much to do with the existential condition of humanity, of ourselves, that this one I will read to you in its entirety, which is not difficult owing to its brevity. Another day passed, and the seventh night fell. And the dead came again, this time with pitiful gestures, and said, "We forgot to mention one thing that we would like you to teach us about men, about humans." And Philemon stepped before me and began to speak, and this is the seventh sermon to the dead. "Man is a gateway through which you pass from the outer world of gods, daimons, and souls into the inner world, out of the greater into the smaller world, macrocosm, microcosm, so forth. Small and inane is man." In my translation I had insignificant, which is probably a little bit less insulting than inane. So you see, I was kinder than these translators. "Inane is man. Already he is behind you, and once again you find yourselves in endless space in the smaller or inner infinity." So you leave humanity behind. You leave your humanity behind as you go within. "At immeasurable distance, a lonely star stands in the zenith. This is the one God of this one man. This is his world, his pleroma, his divinity. In this world, man is Abraxas, the creator and destroyer of his own world. But this star is the God and goal of man. This is his one guiding God. In him, man goes to his rest. Toward him goes the long journey of the soul after death." Once again, I think a star would be called it, but perhaps, you know, it would be toward it goes the long journey of the soul after death. But on the other hand, everything is ensouled. Everything has a spirit in it in the Red Book, so it's called him. "In him, everything that man withdraws from the greater world shines resplendently. To this one God man shall pray. Prayer increases the light of the star. It throws a bridge across death. It prepares life for the smaller world and assuages the hopeless desires of the greater. When the greater world or the outer world grows cold, this star shines. Nothing stands between man and his one God, so long as man can turn away his eyes from the flaming spectacle of Abraxas. Man here, God there. Weakness and nothingness here, eternal creative power there. Here is nothing but darkness and clammy cold. There, all is sunshine." Here I used my translation. "There is the total sun," they say here. Very powerful and very, certainly very poetic sermon. As amplifying and explanatory material, the editor adduces a footnote. consisting of a part of a letter written by Jung on February 29, 1919, so about 3 years after this was written, to a friend named John Carey. And this is part of what he wrote. The primordial creator of the world, the blind creative libido, becomes transformed in man through individuation. And out of this process, which is like pregnancy, arises a divine child, a reborn God. Being one and this individual, and at the same time all individuals, the same in you and me. In the last sermon, you find that he's still writing to her, so obviously she had access to the sermon by that time. In the last sermon, you find the beginning of individuation, out of which the divine child arises. The child is a new God, actually born in many individuals, but they don't know it. He is a spiritual God, a spirit in many people, yet one and the same everywhere. And then he says to the lady whom he is writing, keep to your time and you will experience his qualities. So maybe we need to keep to our time and we will experience it also. So this explanation certainly can make the seventh sermon somewhat plainer to us. The message bears close similarity to Gnostic teachings as well as to alchemy. In Gnosticism, it is universally held that within all human beings there exists a spark of the divine, which, however, is rendered latent by blind forces of great power. Here Jung calls them the blind creative libido, which echoes Schopenhauer's expression, who called it the blind creative will. I remember when I was in my teens when I first studied Schopenhauer, that, you know what, even if your German is pretty good, Schopenhauer is not easy to study. But when I came across that, the blind creative will, I said, this guy knows something. You know, this guy knows something. And so he calls it the blind creative libido, which is, you know, really just psychic energy. Responding to various salvific stimuli, this indwelling spark of deific potential comes to be realized and liberated from its long confinement in darkness and limitation. In alchemy, the deific philosopher's stone is potentially present in the world and in material substances and is subjected to certain procedures, and then a radical transformation takes place, which ends in the emerging of the lapis or the stone. So you can see the similarity of the underlying process. That is, this Gnostic, from a religious and a mystical cosmological point of view, and the alchemists from the point of view of their symbolism within the material substances, are talking about the same thing. A potential, a tremendous, unimaginably powerful and vast and glorious potential can be realized as the result of a process of transformation. Can you see the intimation now of Jung's ultimate willingness after a few years to express the inspiration and the wisdom that he has received in the Red Book through alchemy? And of course we'll talk about that later, because obviously it became evident to him that to put forth this material as it was, I think we can justifiably say, as it was given to him at that time, would not have accomplished much. But by using the alchemical symbolism and combining it with the psychological interpretation and amplification, he could appeal at least to a considerable number of people, in addition to having rehabilitated alchemy in a psychological way. So the need to accomplish this transformation-liberation of the indwelling divine potential is certainly one of the principal messages, if indeed not the chief message of the Red Book. Now, you know, we'll talk about these things on subsequent occasions, but you could say with much justification that at least in some form, you know, this message has been present in many sources, that it is certainly present in some of the greatest of the Christian mystics, Angelo Silesius, I could quote you the passages, Tauler, Saint Bernard of Clairvaux, all kinds of people, and, you know, and certainly also in Eastern sources. But why is it then that while we had these statements all along, and we had them from the surviving Hermetic and at that time the few Gnostic works, that it wasn't practiced, that it did not really penetrate except perhaps to one or two? It was because the culture, the religion, the academic world studied these testimonies in a predominantly intellectual way. Aha, it's a theory. Yes, you know. Interesting theory. And then, oh yeah, the one over there had the theory also. I've seen it in the textbooks, I've heard it in the classrooms, I know how these things were handled. And so what happens here in the Red Book, under the influence of Philemon and some of the other figures, Jung is put through the experience. Jung is having the experience. And now he knows that these are not matters for a theoretical consideration. These are matters for experience. And so the Red Book has to act as a stimulus for our own experience. And I say this because I am convinced that at this very moment already, since the book has been out now a few months, there are all kinds of people, both those who call themselves Jungians and others who probably don't call themselves anything, who are, say, oh well, that's really, really a fascinating theory. You see? Really a fascinating theory. And there it will be put on the theoretical shelf once more. And they will discuss, how does this theory compare to another theory, you know? So where is the shadow? Where is the shadow? Where is the ego? Where is this? Where is that? And by doing that, even though we are using expressions of Jungian psychology, we are once again taking it out of the realm of experience. And of course, that is fatal. That is fatal. And that is something that ought not to be done. However, our time is moving along with us very, very quickly. So, Philemon himself presents a magnificent poetic explanation of the mystery implicit in the seventh sermon, and I'll read you this one because it's very, very important. But when Philemon had finished, the dead remained silent. Now that's a blessing. Heaviness fell from them, and they ascended like smoke above the shepherd's fire who watches over the flock by night. But I returned to Philemon and said, Illustrious one, you teach that man is a gateway through which the procession of the gods passes. And just think of that metaphor, think of the meaning of that, that we are a gateway through which the procession of the gods passes, through which the stream of life flows, through which the entire future streams into the endlessness of the past. Philemon answered, saying, These dead believed in the transformation and development of man. Keep in mind again, believed. You can believe in all kinds of things. If nothing happens, then your belief will not do anything. In any event, these dead believed in the transformation and development of man. They were convinced of human nothingness and transitoriness. Nothing was clearer to them than this, and yet they knew that man even creates his gods. and so they knew that the gods were of no use. Therefore, they had to learn what they did not know, that man is a gateway through which crowds of the train of the gods and the coming and passing of all times. He does not do it, does not create it, does not suffer it, since he is the being, the soul being, since he is the moment of the world, the eternal moment, namely the human. Whoever recognizes this stops being flame. He becomes smoke and ashes. He lasts and his transitoriness is over. He has become someone who is. You dreamed of the flame as if it were life. But life is duration. The flame dies away. I carried that over. I saved it from the fire. That is the son of the fire flower. You saw that in me. I myself am of the eternal fire of light. That's an interesting way in which Philemon speaks of himself. But I am the one who saved it for you, the black and golden seed and its blue starlight. You eternal being, what is length and brevity? What is the moment and eternal duration? You being are eternal in each moment. What is time? Time is the fire that flares up, consumes, and dies down. I saved being from time, redeeming it from the fires of time and the darkness of time, from gods and devils. But I said to him, illustrious one, when will you give me the dark and golden treasure and this blue starlight? Because he speaks of this treasure that he brought over, he brought out of the process. Philemon replied, when you have surrendered everything that wants to burn in the holy flame. So there are definitely clear indications here, not only of the nature of the process, but of other profound mysteries as well. The dead are once again described as human beings who believed in a sort of transformation and development of man. And that was sort of strange to me when I read that. Well, isn't that what you are talking about? But I think that that is something else. We are dealing here probably with the, once again, with the Enlightenment era teaching of human perfectibility, which comes to be interpreted in rationalistic terms as evolution, evolution with a biological basis. The dead abandoned belief in God or gods. They did not know the true spiritual and transcendental role of the human being as a gate toward transcendental being. So Philemon's final sentence in this discourse, I saved being from time, redeeming it from the fires of time and the darkness of time, from gods and devils. So these words indicate once again that Philemon is much more than a fantasy figure or a mask for Jung's higher self as such, but rather an avataric figure, a salvific hierophant, telling Jung that he would receive the dark and golden treasure only when he has surrendered everything that wants to burn to the holy flame, indicates that one must sacrifice many elements of one's psyche that need to be burned by the holy flame. It's also, it's a very interesting twist, and I'll conclude on that note, that these elements that act as obstacles within our nature to the greater, to the birth of the divine child within us, that they themselves, what they really want to be burned up. To us it appears as they are holding us back. They're standing here as obstacles, as sentinels, as, you know, the stone that needs to be rolled away. As Blavatsky said at one time, he who has the strength to roll back the stone of matter from his own inner sanctuary, he has the risen Christ in him. Jung could have very easily written that. But you see, the stone, apparently, the stone wants to be rolled away. The stone is part of the process also. The stone has its own consciousness, and it doesn't want to really act as an obstacle anymore. And if we let it, then it will move into the flame and burn up. The obstacles will burn up, and we will stand freely capable of confronting the greater reality, the greater glory, which to experience has been our calling and our destiny all along. And these, I think, are amazing and wonderful insights which need to be internalized and need to become part of our experience. And if indeed they will, then something very, very marvelous and very, very gloriously promising has come to us in this time and in this year. And I do feel very, very strongly that that indeed is the case. So I thank you very much.
Copyright Memorials by BC Recordings, catalog number 200511. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.